Hello, this is Al Reynolds. I'm reading to you from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 6th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, top of the fold, nursing home to shutter, 123 jobs gone, by Jason DeBrun, from Chapel Hill. A Chapel Hill nursing home that's been the subject of a state investigation, lawsuits, and arrests is closing its doors and laying off all 123 employees. Being dismissed are 9 certified registered nurses, 23 certified licensed practical nurses, and 66 Level 1 certified nursing assistants, among other staff. The closing will be effective June 1. Principal Long-Term Care, based in Kinston, operates the facility and revealed the closing through a Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, WARN, W-A-R-N, notification required by law. Principal operates multiple nursing homes across North Carolina. Glenn Potter, Vice President of Human Resources for Principal, filed the closing and layoff notice, but did not return a phone message for comment. An assistant said he would not be made available. A woman named B.B. Hill, in a separate department of Principal LTC, acknowledged receiving questions by email, but did not provide answers, and said representatives would not be made available for a phone interview. 2 years ago, an investigation by the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation led to a nurse being charged with second-degree murder. On June 7, 2010, the Medicaid Investigations Unit of the North Carolina Attorney General's Office arrested Britt Haven registered nurse Angela Almore, who was at the time 44 and lived at 724 Berwick Valley Lane in Cary, and charged her with second-degree murder in connection with the death of Britt Haven resident Rachel Holliday. Almore was also charged with 6 counts of felony patient abuse for conduct related to her providing morphine to 6 other patients at Britt Haven of Chapel Hill, causing their hospitalization. Almore was arrested and placed under a $500,000 secured bond. Her trial is scheduled for June 4th. When Britt Haven closes, it will eliminate 28% of the state-authorized 471 nursing beds in Orange County. Every year, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Division of Health Service Regulation allocates how many new medical beds may be added in various geographical areas and would consider the loss of 133 beds when looking at Orange County. Perhaps Britt Haven intends to move its business west into Wake County. A joint group called Britt Haven Incorporated and Spruce LTC Group LLC has won a bid to build a 120-bed nursing facility in North Wake County. Filings with the Department of Health and Human Services show documents with the names of both Principal Long-Term Care and Britt Haven Incorporated on them. In those documents, it shows that Britt Haven recorded $35 million of net income for the year ending September 30, 2010. That year, Britt Haven recorded $448 million in long-term care revenue. Next up, Doctors Finding Advantages in Part-Time Work, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. When Dr. Amy Erickson faced the choice of raising a family or continuing her work as a physician, she says she easily would have chosen her family. Instead, a third option presented itself, and Erickson jumped on board with a swiftly increasing segment of doctors, those who work part-time. "I really like my job, but there was no way to balance with my kids," Erickson says. Still, she worked hard to become a physician and feared that taking time off would jeopardize her ability to get back in the game. "Medicine is ever-changing," she says. "If I were a patient, I don't know that I would want to go to a doc who took 2 years off." So she decided to work part-time, and Briar Creek Medical Group, part of Wake Specialty Physicians under Wake Med Health and Hospitals, obliged. Now she works a half-day on Wednesdays and full days on Thursdays and Fridays. If I had not been allowed to work part-time, there would have been no way to raise my kids, she says. Erickson is not alone. According to the Physician Retention Survey, published by the American Medical Group Association and SECJA Search, a healthcare recruitment group, shows that 44% of the female physicians and 22% of male physicians are working part-time. Those numbers are up significantly from 2005, when only 29% of female physicians and 7% of male physicians worked part-time. It's a growing trend, says Gregory Griggs, executive vice president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. You have so many more dual professional households now, so it's more of a trend to work part-time. Practices, too, are being more lenient in scheduling. I think you are finding more practices willing to offer some level of flexibility, Griggs says. That's true, at least, of Wake Med, says Erickson. A Wake Emergency Physicians, which staffs emergency departments for Wake Med Health and Hospitals, offering part-time hours is nothing new. In 2002, WEPPA implemented a longevity program in which doctors may work fewer hours but not lose full-time benefits, says practice administrator Michael Brohan. The number of hours required to keep each full-time benefits decreases as each physician reaches various benchmarks of total hours worked since the beginning of their employment. The five benchmarks range from fewer than 5,000 total hours worked to more than 30,000 total hours. At the lowest level, a physician must log 1,650 hours per year and take several night shifts. At the highest, only 1,200 and no night shifts. Brohan has seen results. Before implementing the longevity program, physicians logged 1,800 hours per year on average. That average is down to 1,600 now. The changes have not come without hurdles, though. To provide health insurance to its employees, WEPPA had to self-insure instead of work with a vendor. While the practice is large enough at 72 positions to self-insure, Brohan acknowledges the option might not be available to smaller practices. Still, he says, WEPPA's model is mostly transferable and sees such scheduling as becoming more prevalent in the future. We felt physicians were wanting a better balance of work and lifestyle, he says. Gen X and Gen Y populations are looking for that better balance. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, farewell to the Mint. Restaurant closing may reopen with new brand by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. The owners of the Mint restaurant that's in city-owned space in downtown Raleigh are shutting down the fine dining establishment with plans to reopen with a new name and concept. When the Mint opened in January 2008, it was at the urging of Raleigh city government leaders who wanted to bring a fine dining restaurant to the One Exchange Plaza building on Fayetteville Street. The city even pitched in $1 million toward the cost of converting the former bank office into a restaurant. But the road proved to be a rocky one for the Mint almost from the beginning. Construction was delayed by more than a year, and by the time the restaurant opened, patrons were starting to cut back on entertainment spending due to the recession. Turnover among kitchen staff also presented challenges. In its first year, the Mint generated about $1.8 million in revenue, but it recorded a net loss of nearly $400,000 when expenses and cost of goods were factored in, according to financial information provided by the Mint's parent company, Raleigh Restaurant Group. The Mint was a subject of Triangle Business Journal's year-long Project Survival series in 2008, which focused on the startup experience of a new local business. Rick Jones, a majority owner of Raleigh Restaurant Group, RRG, says the Mint's revenue continued to improve every year. But we don't feel the fine dining we were trying to present is what Raleigh needs downtown right now. Jones would not say when the restaurant would close, nor would he provide details of the new concept. He did say the restaurant would reopen within 90 days once a remodel was complete. It's time to make a concept change that's better fitting for what's going on in downtown Raleigh, he says. Sources have speculated that the restaurant, described by one owner as a dazzling dining dream, could reopen as a steakhouse, and that Jones is trying to find someone else to take over the space instead of just closing down the restaurant. Jones confirmed that RRG is entertaining the option of bringing in new owners under the new concept. RRG's lease of the 8,300 square foot space with the city runs through 2016. If the group elects to sublease the space to another restaurant group, the deal would first have to be approved by the Raleigh City Council. Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen confirms that RRG is current with its lease payments, but he would not comment about the group's plans to change either the restaurant concept or its ownership structure. When the Mint opened, its ownership was split among five families living in the Triangle, all with varying degrees of experience with restaurants and businesses. But the structure shifted in early 2009 when owner-operators Kara Zuckerberg and Chris Hilton took a 15% ownership stake and assumed management of day-to-day operations. Zuckerberg and Hilton since have shifted management responsibilities to other Mint employees as they prepare to open their own restaurant called Oro in the PNC Plaza building in mid-June. Zuckerberg wouldn't comment about the changes happening at the Mint. "Our full-time focus right now is on Oro," she says. Inside the front cover, ex-RBC executive picked to lead troubled bank, by Lee Weisbecker. From Durham, former RBC Bank USA and Bank of Hampton Roads executive Ron Day will become president and CEO of First Carolina State Bank under a plan to put the Rocky Mount-based community bank on a solid footing. Day was RBC's chief administrative officer in Rocky Mount from 2005 to 2009. In 2010, Day was named president and COO of Bank of Hampton Roads. He is expected to step into his new role in April or May when federal and state regulators are expected to approve First Carolina's acquisition by an investor group led by Durham Biosciences executive John A. Williams. Williams, who confirmed both the timing of the proposed acquisition and the hiring of Day, is a former Rocky Mount resident and Edgecombe County Commissioner who co-founded First Carolina State Bank back in 2000 before moving on to other endeavors. He is now CEO of Durham-based Biosignia. He became involved again with the $85 million total asset community bank when he saw it sagging under problem real estate loans. Profitable back in 2007, First Carolina has lost more than $17 million in the past 4 years. In February, the FDIC called the bank significantly undercapitalized and ordered managers to find new cash or a partner. Williams Investment Group is buying a 95% stake in First Carolina from current owner Lansing, Michigan-based Capital Bancorp. Detailed financial terms have not been released. Capital is a one-time $5 billion holding company that owned 50 community banks as far east as North Carolina and west to California, only to see its own real estate lending portfolio head south during the downturn, according to Raymond James analyst Daniel Cardenas. In response, Capital has been selling off its scattered holdings one by one. Williams Group originally had agreed to buy two troubled banks from Capital, First Carolina and Asheville's Pisgah Community Bank, a $28 million total asset lender. Williams says, however, that he's asked the Federal Reserve to be permitted to abandon the Pisgah part of the transaction, saying his investor group wants to focus exclusively on the Rocky Mount Bank instead. Once regulatory approvals are in hand, Williams says his group will install Day, infuse First Carolina with additional cash, and develop a full-service office in Greenville. The four-branch operation has an office in Reidsville that will be maintained, he adds. As of June 30, 2011, First Carolina was Rocky Mount's ninth-largest bank with a deposit market share of 2.8%. The revised First Carolina recap and management plan is good news for the local community, says John Gessman of the Carolinas Gateway Partnership, a Nash Edgecombe County Economic Development Agency. "We always like a success story," he says. And now, rates cut, state tort laws cited, by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh, the state's second largest medical malpractice insurer has cut its premiums in response to the effects of tort reform laws in North Carolina and other states as well as to put it on a more competitive footing. Mag Mutual Insurance Company has cut doctors' premiums by an average of 7.4% in 2012, North Carolina Department of Insurance spokeswoman Carrie Hall says. The company calls 3 percentage points of that a tort reform credit. A spokesman for the Atlanta-based company says the cuts are also aimed at making it a stronger competitor in North Carolina. That's being called out in the marketing we do, spokesman Michael Clone says. We're in a highly competitive market. Mag Mutual's 19% market share in North Carolina trails only Raleigh-based Medical Mutual Insurance Company of North Carolina, which holds a 31% share. Delaware-based Steadfast Insurance Company is number 3 with 4.9%. No other insurer has notified the insurance department of rate reductions. Medical Mutual CEO Dale Jenkins and others in the industry say they need to amass at least a year of claims data under the new law before calculating new rates. It's also too soon to say how much the cut rates are helping to boost Mag Mutual's market share, Clone says. Doctors usually switch carriers only with the new calendar year, and in July, he says, the tort reform law took effect October 1st. Mag Mutual's 3% tort reform credit reflects reduced payouts and litigation costs in Georgia and other states that have overhauled their medical tort laws in recent years, Clone says. The carrier does business in 9 states. Clone also says the immediate cuts are aimed at returning money to the mutual insurer's customer members. All told, the company expects to collect $44 million in premium from its 3,545 customers this year, compared to $47.3 million in the prior year, according to a filing it made last year after the law took effect. Premiums vary widely, with general practitioners paying less than high risk and litigation prone specialties such as obstetrics, but the bulk of policies carry annual rates of $5,000 to $20,000. A key feature of the new North Carolina tort law is a $500,000 cap on court judgments for non-economic damages that can't be quantified, such as pain. The law does not cap economic damages such as medical costs and lost income. It also allows a judge to separate a trial into 2 phases so that a jury can hear evidence on negligence without being swayed by graphic images and other evidence about the injury itself. Critics of the law say it's discouraging some attorneys from taking on clients with meritorious but difficult-to-prove cases. Critics also note that premiums for medical malpractice insurance have been declining for years in North Carolina, and about 1/3 fewer lawsuits were filed against clients of Medical Mutual between October 1 and February 29th than in the same period a year earlier, the company revealed in early March. The reasons for the decline are unclear for now, says CEO Jenkins. And now, a big shift for the North Carolina Zoo. Support group may take over operations. By Lauren K. Arsange from Asheboro. Changes could be afoot for the North Carolina Zoological Park. Operations of the zoo in Asheboro, one of only 2 state-owned zoos in the nation, the other being in Minnesota, could be placed under a public-private partnership in a move that supporters say would save the state money and eliminate bureaucracy where capital projects are concerned. The move was recommended in a study ordered by the General Assembly and is among ideas that could save the state almost $2 million a year on various attractions, including 3 coastal aquariums. As envisioned for the zoo, an existing support group, the North Carolina Zoo Society, would still receive money for operations from the state, but would take over operational control and be responsible for generating needed funding not provided by the state for operational and capital purposes. The state would continue to own the zoo, which is situated on 2,700 acres of land. Dee Freeman, Secretary of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, which now oversees the zoo, says a legislative committee is in its final deliberations. The zoo has about 260 full-time employees and 80 temporary workers during the summer season. All but 22 of the full-time workers are state employees. The legislation being discussed would shift all employees to the Zoo Society payroll instead of under his department, Freeman says. While the state has continued to support the zoo, that financial aid has dwindled and fell from $11.5 million last year to $10.8 million in the current year. Chief of Staff Mary Joan Pugh says that amount barely covers payroll for the zoo, which has expenses of more than $17 million annually. Under the proposed partnership, the state allotment would be stabilized at $10 million a year, and the Zoo Society would be charged with making up the rest through admission fees, fundraising, a freer hand in marketing the attraction, and other creative means. But that addresses only operations, not much-needed capital improvements, and even dire cases of maintenance work that have not been done for a lack of funding. Zoo Director David Jones has put a cost estimate on capital needs at $30 million. It's not being addressed because, obviously, the state hasn't got the funding right now, he says. We have not been getting the $2 million to $3 million a year that we really need to make sure the place is properly maintained. Case in point, a 28-year-old African pavilion has already matched its life expectancy. The Teflon roof was only supposed to last 15 years. Replacing the concrete and cast iron building alone would cost more than $30 million, but it is necessary. The concrete is crumbling, Jones says. I don't think we can keep it open for much longer. Most animals have been removed from the exhibit. Baboons, ducks, some small mammals, and reptiles do still live there, as well as an amazing plant collection. A flood or roof damage would mean instant closure. It's right in the middle of the zoo, he says. If you close a building like that, it impacts the whole zoo. Raleigh businessman Earl Johnson, Jr., chairman of the Zoo Society Board, says members from across the state would be added to the board and fundraising efforts would be intensified if the partnership gets the green light. We solicit money for membership from the public for projects that need support from the private side, he says. Our role, what we do today, will be the same. He says the society typically raises about $5 million a year and counts 2,600 households as members. Lawmakers are also discussing outsourcing operations at the state's three aquariums and closing some museums. Next up, despite surge in price, stock of Red Hat still attractive, by Lauren K. Arsalls. From Raleigh, the world's newest billion-dollar company, Raleigh's Red Hat is red hot, say analysts, but is it too hot for investors? Not according to stock analysts such as the folks at Cowen & Company, who rate Red Hat overall as a five-star investment, or those at Credit Agricole Securities, who put the company at 4 out of 5 stars. Among the reasons for their bullishness, as businesses replace their computer hardware, they're updating their Sun Microsystems Unix operating systems with Red Hat's Linux open source systems, says R.W. Baird analyst Steve Ashley. Ashley says Red Hat's offering is cheaper and better, a big factor in the company's growth. Typically, those two words haven't gone together, he says. Now on Red Hat's plate, beyond its core offering for networked computers, is open source software to run modern data centers and the cloud, which is the term applied to vast data center storage capabilities. The cloud lets you put many applications in one box, Ashley says. It's much more efficient. Red Hat Vice President Scott Crenshaw, who oversees the company's cloud business unit, calls cloud storage the biggest shift in the market in 30 years, and one in which Red Hat is dominating. The majority of the world's largest public clouds run on technology that Red Hat built, he says. The battle is between Red Hat and Microsoft, he says, adding that he feels the customizable software model of Red Hat is in prime position to control market share. The cloud will determine what companies win and lose over the next decade, he says. And it's that new enterprise that could keep Red Hat on track for sustainable growth, says Baird's Ashley. This is the first inning, he says. There's a long runway, which is another reason that their stock has reacted so nicely. Baird makes a market in Red Hat securities, and the firm and or its affiliates have been compensated by Red Hat for non-investment banking securities-related services in the past 12 months. Indeed, Red Hat shares are up by 47% since the first of the year and now sell in the $61 range. On March 29th, CEO James Whitehurst walked investors through the company's fiscal 2011 financial report, in which it crossed the $1 billion barrier, reporting revenue of $1.13 billion, up 25% over the previous year. Chief Financial Officer Charlie Peters says the October $139 million acquisition of Gluster, a developer of software to manage data storage centers that's now known as Red Hat Storage, helps solidify the company's offerings. William Blair analyst Bahan Suri says that while the stock price may seem high, from a valuation perspective, it's actually not much. For a price sales and price earnings basis, the stock appears expensive at 9 times and 52 times, respectively. Suri says that's due to the Red Hat subscription model for its software. The average duration of a subscription is 22 months, and revenue comes in over time as subscription fees are collected. He says that means analysts should look at valuation from an enterprise value free cash flow basis. It's not like you're collecting the revenue up front like you do for other software companies, Suri says, adding that cash flow funds growth and that Red Hat's cash flow is estimated to grow north of 25% this year. The company is trading at 32 times, he says. That's actually below the software as a service group median of 35 times. It's a pretty reasonable valuation for a company that's in such a unique position and is so key to where the future of tech is going, he says. Drexel Hamilton analyst James Gilman says that as the price of the stock rises, a split is possible, but unlikely. Institution investors, whether it's $100 or $600, they're buying 100,000 shares at a time, so share price is not necessarily important, he says, noting, for example, that high prices don't stop institutional investors from picking Apple Incorporated. Disclosed on Suri's report is that William Blair & Company receive or seek to receive compensation for investment banking services from Red Hat. Drexel Hamilton makes a market in Red Hat stock, and Gilman or a member of his household serve as officer, director, or advisory board member of Red Hat and own shares of Red Hat. Here's an addendum to the article previously broadcast. What is cloud computing? Just what is cloud computing and how does Red Hat fit into the picture? Think of the computer on your desk and the number of applications you use each day. Now think of the electronic space eaten up by those applications and the time and expense to keep them running and updated. With the cloud, all of those applications are moved from your computer to giant data storage facilities along with your data. Once you connect into the cloud, your applications no longer are a product but rather a service that you access and pay for as needed. The result for companies is less maintenance and improved flexibility in staying current with changing business demands. Running the cloud are applications developed by various vendors, Red Hat being among them with its open source offerings. The Raleigh company is not interested in owning or operating data centers, i.e. the hardware part of the business, but it is working to stay cutting edge with the software that manages the data centers. That's where the money comes in. Operators of the data centers collect from users of services stashed in the cloud. Red Hat charges operators of data centers fees on a subscription basis to use its software to manage the data. Red Hat CEO James Whitehurst told analysts and investors on March 29th while discussing the company's earnings report, quote, customers are looking to Red Hat to help modernize their data centers with reliable, high-performing, and agile technologies that prepare their infrastructure for cloud computing and the growth of big data, end quote. And now, as bank nameplates shift, so do execs running them. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Recent mergers have set off a game of musical chairs in the executive offices at Triangle Banks. A host of new faces, and some familiar ones, are now in the power seats and making the important calls at three local institutions. The final C-level lineups at all three banks remain works in progress, but here's a primer of where they stand now. First, PNC Bank's Paula Freiland is head of the Pittsburgh Bank's Eastern North Carolina and Raleigh operations. A Rutgers grad and a 20-year PNC veteran, she has established herself atop that downtown high-rise that once bore the letters RBC. Currently making the rounds and pressing the flesh, Freiland is but the advance guard, however. Bank spokesman Fred Solomon says PNC continues to assemble the cast of executives who will fill out the top slots in its triangle operation. Once that's been accomplished, PNC will hire additional bankers to cross-sell the bank's arsenal of retail products. Solomon provides little information about the process, however. In the normal course of business, PNC does not break out information on local leadership below the level of the regional president and retail market operations manager, he says, and we consider the number of bankers in the region to be competitive information. Second, Crescent State Bank is the closest of the three to having a complete new team in place. Scott Custer, a well-known name in Triangle and regional banking, is CEO. He is also CEO of Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, the private equity group that took a controlling interest in Crescent State last year. Top management slots below Custer are Steve Jones, president of both Piedmont Community Bank Holdings and Crescent State Bank, and Chris Moore, Raleigh Triangle Area Market President for Crescent. Jones says Piedmont continues to set its sights on developing a regional banking franchise with total assets of $3 billion to $7 billion. This year, he says, should see another acquisition somewhere in the Carolinas or Virginia, along with the integration of all the acquired banks into a single entity. In the meantime, bankers at 15 Crescent branches from Cary to Wilmington will be focusing on making small business loans and other bread and butter issues, he says. Adding, we feel like we are in a very good niche. Third, Capital Bank was once one of the area's high-profile community banks, but now has been rolled into a large regional bank operation with a $6 billion in total assets and 152 branches in five southeastern states. Capital is now under the umbrella of Charlotte-based North American Financial Holdings, a private equity group. Former Bank of America executive Eugene Taylor in Charlotte calls the shots for the entire operation, including Raleigh. Matters are not settled by Taylor, go to CFO Chris Marshall, also based in Charlotte. The top Raleigh-based executive nowadays is Michael Moore, the chief financial officer for the Legacy Capital Bank, says North American spokeswoman Tammy Weaverick. Former Capital CEO Grant Yarber left the bank last year. Next up, angel-backed startup focuses on eating issues. By Jason DeBruin, from Durham. As recently as 1998, the Triangle had plenty of diet programs but few treatment options for people with eating disorders. Now the area is emerging as a leader in treating eating disorders, and a new for-profit organization intends to position itself in that market. Angel investors have pooled $3.5 million to start Veritas Collaborative, a treatment center for adolescents with eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating. Jeff Clark, co-founder of Aurora Funds, led the fundraising and serves on the Veritas board. Stacy McIntyre, president and CEO, and Chase Bannister, chief clinical officer, came from Carolina House, a treatment center that works with women 17 years and older. While they helped many people there, McIntyre says she wanted to start a facility that focuses on adolescents. It became clear to me that there were needed to be more treatments for adolescents, she says. Veritas has 8 on staff but plans to increase that to 40, who will be working out of a 30,000-square-foot treatment center that's being updated in the Hawk Plaza 2 building near Duke University Hospital in Durham. McIntyre expects to treat 140 to 160 patients per year, with each patient staying at the facility from 30 to 90 days. The facility will have 5 inpatient beds that are regulated by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Division of Health Service Regulations. It will have 13 residential beds that are not regulated by the state. The industry can be profitable. Cupertino, California-based CRC Health Corporation, owns Carolina House and other such facilities throughout the nation. Through 3 quarters, the company was on pace to record $81 million in operating income and $455 million in client service revenue in 2011, according to filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Clark says Veritas is well-capitalized and existing investors do not intend to raise more money in the near term. Information filed with DHSR shows Veritas expects to spend $1.7 million to upfit and equip the space at Hawk Plaza 2. While Durham was 4 years been home to centers that help people lose weight, such as Structure House and the Rice Diet Program, the area only more recently has begun developing a sector aimed at psychologically induced problem eating, known widely as eating disorders. Besides Veritas and Carolina House, Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have eating disorder treatment centers, each led by a prominent expert in the field. One of the most important aspects in treating an eating disorder is to incorporate the family, says Nancy Zucker of Duke and Cynthia Bulick of UNCCH. What people don't realize is that these are genetically influenced disorders. Although the disorders are psychological, there are obvious physical effects which make them the most fatal of all psychological disorders. Too often, family members are blamed for a disorder when instead they are the most important factor in helping a patient recover, says Zucker. The programs at Duke and UNCCH are somewhat different. Duke does not have inpatient beds and treats patients through what Zucker calls intensive outpatient services. Patients never stay overnight, and Duke typically has around 100 patients enrolled at any one time. UNCCH has 10 inpatient beds and 12 partial hospitalization slots. For inpatient services, patients stay at the hospital for an average of 32 days. UNCCH has treated more than 1,000 patients and performs about 220 evaluations per year. Continuing on, Amazon ruling casts doubt on North Carolina online sales tax law, by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, a court ruling in Colorado could throw into doubt North Carolina's two-year effort to tax online retailers such as Amazon.com. A federal judge in Denver has tossed out a 2010 Colorado statute that aimed to force online retailers to collect state sales taxes. North Carolina put a similar statute to dub the Amazon tax on the books a year earlier. We believe this is a big development, says Susan Taplinger of the New York-based Direct Marketing Association, the group that brought the lawsuit challenging the Colorado law. The ruling's implications for like statutes on the books of a handful of other states, she adds, will have to play out. Asked about the matter, Beth Stevenson, spokeswoman for the North Carolina Department of Revenue, did not respond. Other groups following the issue say it's still too early to conclude what effect the Colorado case will have. The ruling was handed down on April 4th. This has just happened, says Mark Robin of the Washington-based Tax Foundation, but we will be following it. The stakes from North Carolina's point of view can be measured in the millions of dollars. University of Tennessee researcher Donald Bruce, in a study performed prior to North Carolina's adoption of its 2009 sales tax law, put the state's annual losses in online tax revenue in the $190 million to $213 million range. The North Carolina law, like Colorado's, took the position that the fact that large online retailers like Amazon were using in-state affiliates whose websites linked to Amazon offerings was enough of a connection or nexus to begin collecting state sales taxes. Amazon, which had been paying sales taxes only in five states where it has bricks and mortar operations, responded to passage of the law by canceling all of its North Carolina affiliate programs. It did the same in Colorado. In his ruling on the Colorado law, U.S. District Judge Robert Blackburn said the approach imposed an undue burden on interstate commerce. Following adoption of the North Carolina law in 2009, state revenue officials used a variety of methods to collect. Under one 2010 program, they offered amnesty to hundreds of web merchants who could pay what they owe the state on purchases made by North Carolina residents without having to worry about interest payments and penalties. Fewer than 30 signed on. In the same year, the state sued Amazon, seeking $15 million in unpaid state sales taxes and demanding detailed information on purchases made by North Carolina consumers between 2003 and 2010. Amazon responded by disclosing its in-state sales information, but not customer identity information. A judge subsequently dismissed the state suit. Next up, don't sweat it. Even with 984 code, 919 numbers remain. By Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. Businesses or individuals getting a new phone number don't have to worry about losing out on a chance to embrace an old friend, the 919 area code, in favor of the new kid on the block, the 984 code. While the 984 area code will now force Triangle callers to dial 10 digits for every call, telephone companies can't even begin assigning the 984 code until April 30th, and they probably won't even do so then. That's because there's a repository of some 180,000 numbers available with a 919 area code. As of February 29th, in fact, the 919 area code had 18 available three-digit prefixes, each with 10,000 four-digit numbers, according to the data from the North American Numbering Plan Administration, or NANPAA. That's enough to last through October if telephone companies request prefixes at the same pace as last year. So telephone companies probably won't begin ordering up 984 numbers until the 919 numbers are gone, unless a few large businesses or enough customers request them. So far, few or none have done so. The 984 area code is an overlay, meaning that it geographically matches 919, stretching from Goldsboro through the Triangle's urban core to Siler City and Oxford. The overlay approach has historically prompted less grumbling than geographical splits, which can require companies in a newly established area code to print reams of new marketing materials. In some areas with overlays, customers have actually clamored for the new area code, says John Manning, senior director at NANPAA. Manning cites demand for the 667 area code that was introduced in March as an overlay of 410 in Baltimore and Eastern Maryland. Paytech, a provider of telecom services for small businesses, will continue assigning 919 numbers well past April 30th, says Scott Morris, a spokesman for Paytech's Little Rock, Arkansas-based parent company, Windstream. Windstream Paytech won't have exhausted our supply of 919 numbers at that point, so we'll continue giving out those numbers, Morris says. Frontier Communications, the primary landline provider in Durham and surrounding areas, is in a similar situation because no customers have requested 984 numbers, says Regional General Manager Susan Scott. Manning says the first customers likely to do so are large organizations wanting hundreds of consecutive numbers. Next up, employers gain new rights in revisions to workers' comp. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Time was, a supervisor suspicious of an employee on workers' comp injury leave couldn't just dial up the employee's doctor. But now employers can do just that. It's a major provision of a law passed overwhelmingly by the General Assembly in June. The law aims to bring down costs in the workers' compensation system, largely by curbing abuses. It's a big issue for businesses, particularly those in higher-risk industries. Workers' comp insurance can amount to 30% of payroll in some industries, says James Moore, a risk management consultant in Raleigh. A construction company, for example, that pays $50,000 to a worker in annual wages might have to pay an additional $15,000 in workers' compensation premiums. Premiums average about 22% in a high-risk business such as the trucking industry and as little as 1% to 2% for low-risk office workers, Moore says. About 26,000 claims for workers' compensation were filed in the second half of 2011, 9% fewer than in the second half of 2010, according to the NC Industrial Commission, which oversees the workers' comp program. It's too early to determine whether the new decrease is somehow related to the new law. Most companies underwrite workers' comp claims by purchasing insurance, while some larger companies are self-insured. People in the system say some self-insured companies are beginning to see reduced costs, though outside insurers haven't yet begun to cut rates for workers' comp insurance. The nonprofit North Carolina Rate Bureau could conceivably ask the state's Department of Insurance to approve lower rates following an annual review in September, says Sue Taylor, the Bureau's Director of Insurance Operations. Dealing with physicians is but one area covered by the legislation. One involves the duration of benefits for various categories of injured workers. For one classification, totally disabled, benefits that used to be perpetual are now limited to 500 weeks, or about 9 years and 7 months. Another provision actually extends a period when workers and their families can draw disability benefits. Still, other provisions that are aimed at keeping up with changes in health care draw praise from workers and employers alike. But the provisions on medical information tend to benefit employers, say attorneys for employers and workers. Not only are employers now allowed to contact doctors directly to get a feel for when an employee might return to work, for example, they might also act on suspicions that a putatively disabled employee is actually playing beach volleyball every day, says lawyer Buck Copeland, a partner with Cranfield, Sumner, and Hartzog in Raleigh, who represents employers. Copeland is quick to add that such cases are not common, but they can represent big expenses for an employer. The new law gives general guidelines for that doctor-employer communication, but courts will ultimately have to lay them out in greater detail, Copeland says. The communication may help employers in some of the cases that end up in litigation, attorneys say. It can't do anything but harm the plaintiff's case, Copeland says. Leonard Jernigan, a lawyer who represents injured employees in workers' comp claims, says the law limits employees' ability to switch doctors. While the old system also allowed the employer to choose the doctor, switching entailed fairly routine approval by the North Carolina Industrial Commission, Jernigan says. In a practical sense, you can't just pick a doctor and go to them anymore, he says. The new system also gives greater weight to the opinion of the doctor. The employer selects to assign what's known as a disability rating. After recovering, an injured worker is evaluated by a doctor and assigned a long-term disability rating that determines whether he or she qualifies for disability payments and how large those payments should be. The employee can get a second opinion, but the commission is no longer required to consider it. Moreover, the second doctor may believe that the employee is not yet fit to return to work, but the commission is legally required to ignore such an assessment, Jernigan says. The bill passed 110-3 in the State House of Representatives, 46-0 in the Senate, and was signed by Governor Beverly Perdue in late June. And now it's time for A Better World. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Women's Group in Chapel Hill, merging. Since it was formed in 1978, the Women's Center in Chapel Hill has worked to equip women and girls to be more self-sufficient. And since it began operating in 2000, the Family Violence Prevention Center, also in Chapel Hill, has worked to prevent domestic abuse. Now, after working together for more than 10 years and after 8 months of discussions that included meetings nearly every week of members of their respective staffs and boards, the two agencies are preparing to merge, probably in July, forming the new Compass Center for Women and Families. While it may result in some savings in administrative costs, the merger is designed to improve and expand services to current and prospective clients of the two agencies, their executive directors say. There is not duplication of services, Hudson Fuller, executive director of the Family Violence Prevention Center and incoming chief operating officer of the new Compass Center. We have a shared goal of providing more comprehensive services to all members of the community in terms of providing safety and self-sufficiency to women and men so they have the ability to take care of themselves and their families. Amy Gerhardt, executive director of the Women's Center and incoming executive director of the Compass Center, says another key goal of the merger is to be better stewards of resources in our community. The Women's Center operates with an annual budget of $410,000 and a staff of 5 people and serves nearly 3,000 clients a year. The Family Violence Prevention Center operates with an annual budget of $275,000 and a staff of 5 people and serves about 750 clients a year. One likely result of the merger will be longer-term services for victims of domestic violence that will help them break the cycle of violence, Fuller says. Because of its limited resources, she says, the Family Violence Prevention Center has found it tough to help victims free themselves from dependence on their abusive partners. Gerhardt says the merged organization aims to increase its focus on providing services such as financial literacy, career exploration, and workforce development to victims of domestic violence. A woman really can't leave a situation until she's ready to be self-sufficient, she says. Data suggests a key factor in domestic violence or abuse is control of the household finances, Gerhardt says, and many women and men in abusive relationships may not have control of their finances or know very much about how to manage them. The merger is the result of a lot of time and effort, Gerhardt says. Most Monday evenings from July through February, staff and board members from both agencies met to address issues such as the agency's mission, corporate structures, finances, client bases, programs, staffing and staff culture, facilities, space needs, fundraising, and donors. The merger is designed to build our capacity to not just provide our current clients with more comprehensive services, Fuller says, but also to be able to serve more clients in the community overall. And now a word from the editor's notebook, Sugata Mukherjee. Social media's growing influence. With so many smartphones out, and the thirst for folks to keep up with the news, and current status of their family, friends, and colleagues, it is abundantly clear that social media is here to stay. While some say that the use of social media marketing is being stitched into a company's DNA, others argue that some companies are still trying to figure out how to use the various channels of communication effectively and profit from available resources. Think about it for a second. If everyone is on the platform, how does one rise above the chatter? How can you get your voice heard? So, to get a sense of how marketers in different industries feel about social media, and more importantly, how their bosses feel about a company's effort on, say, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and other platforms, I looked at the latest report on social media marketing produced by an outfit named Awareness Incorporated, a social marketing software company. Awareness contacted 320 marketers from C-level execs to project managers and asked them a variety of questions related to the impact, strategy, and profitability of a company's social media culture. Among the findings are, more than 70% of the respondents said they are more involved in social media than the year before. Facebook remains a company's biggest outlet of choice when it comes to social media. About 77% of the respondents said they do not have adequate resources to execute a full social media plan. About 58% of the respondents said their biggest challenge remains the measurement of the ROI, return on investment. Only 19% of marketers reported using a social media management platform despite having a presence and engagement on multiple platforms. Among the metrics that matter, 76% of the respondents said that the number of followers, fans, and likes on different platforms is the most important. Traffic to the website was next, followed by social mentions across platforms. Some companies are convinced that the spend has to come before the ROI. Martin Sorrell, CEO of the WPP Group, said just a few days ago that the company will double its spending from $200 million to $400 million on Facebook. The company spends $2 billion with Google and $5 billion with News Corp. So perhaps WPP is developing its own social media ROI and comparing that to its search ROI. From the thousands of blogs posted by journalists from reputable news organizations, it is clear that the profession is all in when it comes to marketing its own content and adding readers and viewers. The profession as a whole also is being very deliberate in figuring out a way to monetize the intelligence that news organizations provide to their readers. But being engaged in social media is one thing. Quantifying the value of that engagement is another. Such thinking promoted Triangle Business Journal's parent, American City Business Journal, to launch a social media contest in 43 markets, with the winners advancing to a national contest. And why not? Our markets already are choosing winners among individuals, 40 under 40, women in business, CFO of the year, and with companies, Fast 50, Best Places to Work, A Better World Awards. So why not with social media? The contest is called Social Madness, and you can find out more at socialmadness.com. If your company is in social media, you should enter. It's simple, fun, and it may just force you and your leadership to pay a little more attention to your overall strategy to advance in this bracket-style challenge. And please tell us if you're able to quantify your ROI It continues to be the most challenging element in social media. Since a group called the North Carolina Golf Panel was convened in 1995 to rate courses across the state, Pinehurst No. 2 has been deemed the best every year. And so it is in 2012. And that's a testament to the work done in 2010 by designers Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw in restoring the course more closely to what the original designer, the legendary Donald Ross, had in mind. In other ratings, the Dormy Club, just west of Pinehurst No. 2, was selected as the state's best new course. Second to Pinehurst No. 2 in the top 100 for the third consecutive year is Grandfather Golf and Country Club, an immaculately maintained Ellis Maples gem in Linville. Moving up a spot to third is Quail Hollow Club in Charlotte, a George Cobb original fine-tuned by Tom Fazio. Fourth is a Fazio original, the Old North State Club in New London, which is owned by Raleigh's John McConnell. Completing the top five is Pine Needles, a Ross masterpiece in Southern Pines. In a regional ranking, the top triangle courses are Raleigh Country Club, Old Chatham, Treyburn, Hossentry, and Duke University. McConnell also owns RCC and Treyburn, which is in Durham. A new restaurant serving up old recipes is now in business in Cary, called EJ's Soul Food. It's at 140 East Chatham Street, dishing out southern faves like fried chicken, pork chops, meatloaf, fried fish, and even chitlins. The restaurant is a creation of EJ Jones, who relocated to Cary from Maryland. She told the online site, Cary Citizen, quote, "I'm the oldest of eight children, and I was raised by my grandma. Everything was home cooked from scratch," end quote. As it should be. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.